Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You know, it's kind of an odd time right now.
No, I didn't know that. I haven't been paying attention.
And, you know, tensions are high, a lot's going on. I've expected a lot of things as part of what's happening. What I didn't expect was being caught in a fucking tornado with my kids this morning.
Oh, I saw a tornado warning. For real?
No way. In it. Like, in it. I wasn't even in a fucking house, man. Oh, my goodness. I'm like, what the fuck is happening?
Did you see it? Was it a real tornado?
I was literally in it.
No, shit. Oh, my God.
Clutching my children.
Oh.
Yeah. So that happened.
Was that the same time that I was screaming at the top of my lungs and cursing at my 8-year-old? Because I felt like I was in a tornado this morning.
I mean, yo, for real? Like,
dude, that's incredibly hairy. I've never, ever.
Dude, it was scary. So you know, I'm on the beach with my kids in my, well, I might give it up. I'm in my undisclosed beach location. And, you know, I see some black clouds coming in. My kids are late. We're out there for an hour. Sun, games, they're into waves. No problems. See, like, a dark, you know, cloud set coming in. People start, you know, getting their umbrellas together and, you know, headed inside. But, you know, I got two kids. It takes a while to pack it down, start making her way up the beach. You know, one of them's little. And, you know, we start getting off the beach and, you know, a couple raindrops come down and then literally walk to the end of, like, the sand runway to the street. And before I know it,
no,
just, like, overtook us. I hear people screaming. Homeboy who's been fixing the deck for the last 3 months is stuck up on a fucking ladder. Both me and my son's hats blow off. They're gone. You know, I'm about to chase it. I'm like, fuck that. I'm holding my daughter already. Then I'm like, it's getting like really nasty. So I just grab my son and I'm like holding him in my chest.
Yeah.
Just clutching them both, basically trying to deflect from like the wind and whatever's coming. And then I'm looking around and I'm like, I got fucking nowhere to go. And like shit just might hit us. I gotta get out of here. And I just pick both of them up, you know, with the umbrella and the bags. And I just start trembling, you know, into the house. We gotta get inside. You know, they're spooked.
Yeah.
Real spooked.
Oh, yeah.
Finally get in. Of course, we're in the house. Every window in the house is open, you know, like it was a beautiful, normal day. Oh, my fuck. For fuck's sake. So my daughter was real spooked at first, and then, you know, calmed down when I put something on. My son just would not stop pining about losing his beach hat. So he's out right now getting another beach hat. I lost my very special Brooklyn Nets hat that I bought, that my wife had my son's name embroidered for me at the Governor's Ball show.
Oh, dude.
Yeah, like this very special hat that I meant to like give to him. That I couldn't tell you where the fuck it is though now.
Oh, dude.
But we're inside. We're safe. No one was hurt. Literally a fucking roof of a church got blown off. So
really?
Like, yeah. It was like no joke. So, you know, give a fuck about a hat right now. But still. Woo.
Dude, it's just like when it rains. It's just
But in a way, it's like, it's always that constant thing. It's the same thing as like coronavirus is like, it's like the earth is always here to tell us like we are not the boss, yeah. You know? We yeah. always forget. We get in these human scuffles, which are, you know, needed and, you know, whatever. But, and then she, Mother Gaia, just always comes and makes.
Like, don't think too much of yourself, kids.
Just a statement. She's like, listen, hon. You're very cute. Your family's cute. I've been here a long time. You guys are going to be gone soon. You know, it ain't about you, dog. It ain't about you. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very good lesson. Very good lesson.
I think so. Mother Gaia is all over this.
Oh, God. Dude, that's really incredible, Benny.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's like, you know, you're old. So, you know how sometimes you're just like, how can I even know anymore? You know what I mean? Like, I'm full. I'm done building character. I got nothing left. Like that's it. Like, I've etched too many little fucking carvings in the belt, and I got no mas. Like, right. And then another one. I'm just like, oh, all right. Well, now I've done that, too. I've clutched my children in the middle of a tornado, apparently. Cool.
That's scary, dude.
At least I got them big Papa Bear hands, you know?
Yeah. You know, the tornado, there was a big tornado. I don't know if you remember. It was like maybe 8 years ago in Massachusetts that went right. It went within like a half mile of my parents' house. And
wow.
It devastated the swath that it created. It basically wiped out like a third of my hometown from where I grew up.
Yeah, that shit's crazy. I remember.
It changed the landscape. Like when I go to, even to this day, 8 years later, when I go to visit my parents, it's like part of it I don't recognize. Actually, I guess it was more. Maybe it was 9 years ago. I don't know. It was like a huge tornado that passed through central Massachusetts.
All right, devastating. I remember for years, Gaslight had a hard time getting shows in St. Louis.
Right.
You know, there was the Creepy Crawl, and that was still a little like too big for us almost.
Right.
And we kept getting these offers up in Joplin, Missouri, basically from this one crew of kids who just liked Gaslight and had access to a weird venue up there. Right. So we're just like, all right, fuck it. We'll start going up there. So we started creating this little scene in Joplin, Missouri, you know, where we'd stay with this guy, RJ, and his father. And we went there many times. And yeah, like maybe a year or two after the last time we were there, that town got flattened. And people he knew lost houses. And it was devastating, man. Yeah. You see, I mean, tornadoes are like, natural disaster. It's horrifying, yeah. Truly horrifying. There's nothing you could do about that. Well, speaking of truly horrifying, how's life, Brad? Fuck's sake.
I don't know how to react to things. I'm going up and down, you know? I want to... Yeah.
So we delayed the release a day.
Because our hearts were heavy.
I mean, for a lot of reasons. It's confusing, you know? Like, and even the concept of offering a distraction to people feels strange to me right now because, you know, people hitting the streets and the people in trouble aren't offered a distraction, you know? They just got to stay in it all the time. And so it's confusing. I don't know exactly how to handle this, what's appropriate. So you just got to feel it out and make your own way. But, I mean, I think at the very least, we should recognize the fact that you and I are both on the same page to completely eradicate the things that have been happening over and over and over again.
Absolutely. 100%.
The thing, you know, it always pops into my head is like my experience with all this wasn't personal, but it started way before kind of the media picked up on it and where it started becoming a major thing. So I remember going to a show in New Brunswick in the early mid-90s, like maybe 96, something like that. And just recently, there had been a police shooting in town where apparently a prostitute had assaulted an officer. All she had did was bit him very lightly or something. I don't remember the details exactly. And she was killed. And I went to like a cafe show to see my friend Tyler Rand play, who wound up being in the band Midtown. I don't even remember what kind of show he was playing. And that was the first time I saw like what a menacing police force looked like. they were expecting a protest. They were expecting something to happen in town. And I was parked and walked to this venue and saw a parking lot with like a row of like 35 police cars, like in a row. And it just shook me like to the core.
Yeah, that's what it's intended to do.
I'd never seen anything like that. This just like, it looked like a militarized thing. It looked like they could do anything they wanted unimpeded. And it scared the shit out of me. I couldn't wait to get out of town that day. Then shortly after, like 2 years later, two New Brunswick cops were arrested and then subsequently charged a couple years later for running a brothel in town. And then literally the year later in New York City, Amadou Diallo was killed, which I'm sure you remember. Oh, yeah. And that was like the beginning where I was just, I guess at 18 or 19, even at that time, I was just like, okay, what the fuck is going on with this inequity? But the thing I misunderstood, right, that I want to talk about is like, I think because I didn't grow up like rich and I'm Jewish and I always had a shitty car and a skater and a punk and I've been harassed by cops so many times and I knew situations like that. I almost thought I was in like the same experience.
Right.
You know?
Yes.
I did. And like me had that level of like privilege and a sense of that I truly thought I understood something I did not.
Right.
You know? And then the one thing that's really been crazy to me is I'm thinking about one of the early Gaslight tours. We were trying to make a drive from Birmingham, Alabama to Richmond. You know, quite a trip. And, you know, that trip going through the mountain cuts into like 20 miles of northeast Georgia.
Right.
Right. And we were still in our old shitty van, just the four of us, you know, loaf, like not looking great, probably. And we were pulled over for it was one of those like cops behind you, runs your plate, doesn't see anything, pulls to the driver's seat, see who's driving. Pulls back and then pulls you over, one of those deals.
Yeah.
And, you know, got me out of the car almost immediately, brought me to the back. I wasn't even wearing shoes. So I was barefoot and starts interrogating for almost an hour. And we didn't know what the fuck was going on. It turned out he was just waiting for another guy to show up so he could search us. Right. At that point, you know, I was like, they're playing good cop, bad cop. They're trying to ask all these questions. You know, it was kind of like, hey, we're from New Jersey. We're not going to fall for fucking that shit, okay? We're not admitting anything to you, douchebag, you know? Like, you're going to have to fucking look if you want. And, you know, and they kept us there. And I did. I even had a fear that they were going to plant something on us.
Right.
And it was like one of those really kind of scary police situations where they have all that control over you. And even then, I never thought I was in any kind of physical harm.
Right.
I never thought there was a physical threat to my body or my life through that entire experience. I thought they might plant weed on me. I thought they might lock us up. I thought they might keep us in Georgia. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Not great stuff. But there's a difference here. You know what I mean? And even someone who's like Jewish and a punk from New York City, as fucking liberal as it gets, there's still a fucking difference we have to recognize, like, and fully have to recognize. And if there's anything I can find maybe positive right now is that I think a lot more people are having that reflection.
You know, there's one band that can take you out of it for at least a few songs. And maybe. I may have to go listen to them after this. And
oh, yeah.
We've got their singer here with us for today's episode.
Yeah, so this was so awesome to have Milo on. I wish we were releasing it in a different context when I could have told all the stories about how much I love Milo prior to doing this. But yeah, I didn't, you know, it's a fucking podcast. I got some things to get off my chest, you know? I don't feel like going on Twitter for the next fucking 45 minutes. Yeah, it was awesome that Milo came on with us. The Descendants played a super pivotal role in my life. But this intro is long. Let's get into the interview.
Let's hear Milo, dude. It's going on.
Well, how you doing, man?
I'm okay. Hunkered down. Hunkered down.
Yeah, you're in sunny Southern California, I imagine.
No, I live in Delaware.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
I've been here since what, 99, actually. So I lived here longer than I've lived anywhere else, really.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense when I was putting it together. And that's because of the DuPont connection down there.
Yeah, my wife got a job at the University of Delaware back in 99, and I just kind of, we were living in Wisconsin at the time, and I figured, well, I guess I got to move to Delaware. So,
I mean, those are some big jumps, like growing up full on Southern California style and then winding up in Wisconsin and Delaware. Those are interesting steps. I mean, do you still feel like a Californian in Delaware, or are you a Delaware guy now?
I think I'm a Wisconsin guy.
Oh.
I'm a Wisconsin guy who wished it wasn't so cold there, but like, wouldn't that be great if I could live in Wisconsin? I really liked, we were there for like 9 years, and I really liked the people there, the town. I was in Madison.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. That's
it was
a great.
Town,
man.
Yeah, it's really nice. And when I moved out here, that was a bigger culture shock for me moving to here.
Right.
From Wisconsin than it was moving to Wisconsin from California, just because, I just got used to the pace of life in Madison. Sure. And being able to ride my bike to school or walk to school or just do whatever. And out here, we moved into this, it's a very driving-based culture out here, kind of similar to L.A., really.
Sure. So what was it like for you when this quarantine started? Is there a flashbulb moment for you when this went from, something we were all looking at to something you needed to take really seriously and make a plan for with your family?
I think like March, early March, my daughter said, One Friday or Thursday or Friday, she said, "Well, they're having us leave school early,"
mm-hmm.
and she said, "Can we go to the gym?" And I said, "No, we can't go to the gym.
Right?
That's like COVID central there."
Yeah.
So it was like the first time where I was like, let's not ever go to the gym again,
right.
This kind of thing. So
first thing I took out as well.
But I had. Thoughts earlier on that it was just going to go badly
right
here in the States, because actually I got invited by, I don't know if you know the Dag Nasty guys that do Field Day. Doug and whoever's in Field Day, but Doug Carrion had invited me to play with them in H2O. And this would have been in mid-February.
Oh, right.
And I said, that's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. He said, what's the problem? I said, we are no longer exceptional. You know, people talk about the exceptionalism in the U.S. And we are not that, clearly, at this point. And I had already kind of garnered from watching the news that this is just going to be botched all along, and sure enough. So that mid-February time point, I just kind of really had a sinking feeling that, it wasn't going to work out. And the main reason I figured it wasn't going to work out is because testing was not going to happen.
Right.
That's been the main thing. Is like, you could tell that just they weren't lifting a finger to make that happen in any kind of way, in any kind of effective way. And sure enough, that's how it all went down,
Yeah, it was interesting. It's almost like one of the first times, right, American exceptionalism is actually kind of biting us in the ass, how much better suited would we be if we were in like an autocratic system right now where we're, used to, getting an order from Supreme Leader and then we all just do it and we're, punished greatly if we don't. And in America, three people say one thing, one person has to say the other. And it's...
Yeah.
It's like one of the first times I think it's really biting us in the ass and that, well, maybe not one of the first times, but certainly biting us in the ass. Did you have your background maybe in science and the things you were working on that potentially gave you a better understanding that we were going to be like ill-equipped for this?
Well, I knew that the testing was going to be the testing was going to be something that needed to be done, but that had to be done not half-assed, and had to be done from a very careful perspective. So the main reason why they just got off on the wrong foot is that the original test kits had a contaminant in them. And,
does that happen? Like what's the process that allows that to happen?
Well, because it's based on PCR, which is a type of amplification of DNA. And so it's very easy to just have a tiny bit of other DNA in there that can then be picked up by the amplification process. That's what ended up, I think, happening, is that there was a PCR contaminant in their negative control. So these tests all have to have a negative control, so that you, because what happens if you, every single sample you test is positive, you go, what, that can't be the case. How can everything be positive? Well, it can be positive if there's contamination in there.
Their
negative control was going positive, and so therefore there was a contaminant. And and then they drag their feet waiting like a month or so, or a month or more to kind of correct the error. And right. It was just a complete cluster at that point.
Now, do you think like it was more just general amateurism and sloppiness, or do you think this was much more practical and this is kind of being slow and rolled out the way it is for political and social reasons?
I have to believe that mostly the latter, because I think if you had a quick reporting back, they send out these test kits and then there's going to be these quick reports back like, hey dudes, this isn't working. And then the CDC has got to say, okay, we're fixing this pronto. This is like an ASAP thing. We're fixing the kits. And that didn't happen.
Right.
That clearly did not happen. They dragged their feet, and you know, I guess it could be political why they dragged their feet, or maybe that's where there was actual incompetence at that level, at the bureaucratic level. It doesn't right. matter which it was; they failed, you know.
Yeah, at this point, yeah. So I did a little research last night on Arabidopsis.
Oh, great!
Which I read up. You know, I know it's creepy, but I use the internet to help me. And I found out that you were using Arabidopsis to identify genes important for crop traits.
Yeah.
So I called my friend Nate Morris. He's a guitar player in a band called Polar Bear Club and a bunch of other great bands. And,
I love Polar Bear, but they're not around anymore.
Not around anymore, yeah. But Nate is your kin. He is also a molecular scientist.
And, that's cool.
Yeah, and he's kind of my, you know... get out of jail free card if I ever have a question about this. So right. I was like, you know, I'd love to talk to you a little about it. So the one thing I realized that I thought was cool was this plant, Arabidopsis, right? It's a mustard plant.
Yep.
And it's been being used for study over 150 years for genetic research.
Yeah.
Now, like, he was trying to explain it to me. What exactly is the purpose of everybody using the same plant to study, and why that one?
Well, the reason why you would use a plant like Arabidopsis is that it has a smaller genome than pretty much any other crop plant. So, of course, we'd love to do genetics research directly on corn or directly on soybean.
Right.
But those genome sizes are so big, and just the genetics is more complicated mm-hmm. because of that. And so with a small genome size, it's easier to pinpoint, the function of a particular gene in the genome. And plus if there's lots of tools available for working on that particular model plant. And so for Arabidopsis, you can transform it very easily. That means you can put exogenous nucleic acids into it and then check those exogenous nucleic acids for how they function. Mm-hmm. So those are the two main reasons, is the ease of being able to transform it and the small genome size. And then of course, you know, people then want to know, well, you're not ever going to make a crop out of Arabidopsis. So how do you deal with that? And
right.
what you do is you bank on the fact that within the plant kingdom, there's a fair amount of similarity at the genetic level. Aside from, like I said, the genome sizes and everything, but on a gene per gene basis, you hope that there's enough similarity that you can make that you can extrapolate from genes that you find in Arabidopsis to then some kind of a homologous gene that you'd find, say, in corn or in soybean, that kind of thing. And you have to translate all your findings into the crop plant at that point. That's what we were doing. So my stuff was to work on the so-called model plant, Arabidopsis, and then translate those findings into a crop plant like corn.
Very cool. Yeah. That, like, what? And since you were so involved in that, I mean, I live in a house where, you know, I'd get beaten if I brought certain types of genetically modified foods like through the front door and gave them to my kids and stuff.
Right.
Yeah. Like, you know, and I have this conversation with my wife often where I know there might be negative things to these, but I also don't think the people behind the science ever were malicious about it. It seems like right. The intention was good. Yeah. So what are your thoughts on like genetically modified foods and their safety and the public backlash from, you know, organic eaters and stuff like that?
Well, I mean, I think we'd all, even in the field, we were always working towards more and more less invasive manipulations of the genomes. I mean, the thing about it is, corn and soybean varieties now that give higher yield,
right,
is that the breeders came through and the breeders bred for some of those traits. So how do you breed for traits? You basically make a bunch of crosses between different plants, and you also rely on natural mutation to happen, which, mm-hmm, you know, of course, natural mutation and just natural variation happens all the time between different between different strains of corn, different strains of soybean. So, in fact, we basically use mutants of a sort or genetically modified organisms of a sort to do breeding anyways, because those are genetically modified by nature. They're just not genetically modified by humans.
Sure.
So it's really, you know, when you start talking about genetic modification, anytime you have a corn variety that looks different than another corn variety, it's genetically modified in a broader sense. So I kind of feel like what we were trying to do was just trying to kind of help it happen faster so that we didn't have to rely just on breeding to make it happen. But the other thing in all this that I always think about is I think about like a risk benefit, kind of a risk benefit analysis.
Sure.
And you know, anytime you want to, you know, have a benefit, and this goes for medicine,
yeah,
this goes for just all science or just all science where you're looking at the human good, you're always going to be looking at a risk benefit. And the deal with, you know, like for example, a pharmaceutical that we might get, approved by the FDA, is going to have some risk associated with it, but we always, you know, we always kind of say, well, if the benefit of that to save someone's life is more than the risk, people are willing to assume risk all the time.
Sure.
for that kind of a situation. And I would just submit that the benefit of feeding the world is a huge benefit. You might even say it dwarfs the benefit of curing some obscure disease. You know, we need to feed the world. That's what we really need to do.
Sure.
And that's part of what we are dealing with is we want to make crops that are going to be more hardy and that are going to help us feed the world in the long run. And what kind of risk are you willing to submit yourself to for that? And you know, when I think about the risk of to date, there's been zero cases of people dying from a GMO. That's just the fact of the matter.
Right. Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, and you know, when it comes from the other side, you know, sort of the crunchy community, you know, there's the idea that the FDA is just in the pocket of these companies, you know, certainly someone like DuPont. Like, what was your experience like with that? You know, did you still find the FDA and getting things like approved and researched by them to be a very exhaustive process? Like,
well, I never really dealt with that because mainly because that's like the end game. That's like the last
ten
yards of the whole thing, and we were so far removed from all that, or just so far on the other side of things, on the discovery side.
I see.
That I never really had to deal with it, but it can be a huge headache, and you know, I think it's to be to be expected that it could be a headache, because if the FDA is really doing their job, then they really do have to make sure that these things are safe. And I would definitely never want to, you know, make an end run around them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I sometimes hope they would be huge pains in the asses. You know, that's my hope is that.
Now, they got to do their job.
Yeah, exactly.
I think a lot of our listeners are going to know who Milo is, but can you explain what you guys are talking about? What is your job now, Milo, as a molecular biologist, right?
Well, no, because I got laid off 3 years ago.
Oh.
Yeah. Actually, it was 4 years ago at this point.
Well, explain to our listeners why Benny is talking to you about science, why you would be qualified.
Because he knew that I geek out, even though I don't do it anymore, you know?
Hell yeah. I was just excited to do it, man. I mean, I'm like, this is just, you read through your history, and obviously, you know, from the beginning of Descendants, from really the beginning of when you seem to be interested in anything, you seem to have an equal and weighted interest in this to music.
Yeah.
And one thing I was wondering is, like, you know, going through, you know, looking at what you do and even talking to my friend Nate, I remember, you know, like the whole concept of scientific exploration is it's very democratic, and it needs like community and it needs cooperation. And even, you know, he was explaining the Arabidopsis is useful because there's like 100 years of research data that you can look back upon and, you know, as he said, stand on the shoulder of giants. And when I'm listening to that, I'm like, this is kind of punk rock. Like, it's sort of like a cooperative, community-based system. Like, do you think that was part of your attraction to it?
Well, definitely. I feel like people who like to read about the forefront of research, you know, what's the cutting edge of research. And that would always get me excited. I mean, it gets a lot of scientists, they want to know what's current, what's happening in the now. And then once you get caught up in that, like the new discoveries that are happening, then you feel like, well, I want to participate. And you, well, of course, there's a bit of a barrier there. You got to go get some kind of advanced degree, at least to participate, you know, most directly.
Sure.
But it makes it similar to music and punk in general, is that, you know, that's how I got into punk, because I was a fan, and then I realized, well, maybe I could do this too. I could not only listen to music and get my yah-yahs out that way, but I could actually make music. And so I guess it's similar in that regard. I mean, they share that in terms of a creative link, in terms of, you know, it's like just basic, the passion. It's a similar kind of a passion, I think, between the two.
And was there, like, what do you remember, like, really what drew you into this? Was it a family thing? Was there any kind of connection?
Well, I was in high school and my biology teacher was saying, dude, you got to give us an oral report. everyone had to do an oral report. And I was, believe it or not, I was a fairly shy teenager. And I was like, no, I don't want to. I was really resistant. I kept putting her off and saying, no, I'm not going to do it. And she said, if you don't do it, you're going to fail.
Okay.
And so I was like, oh, fuck. Okay, I got to do it. And I just happened to chance upon an article on recombinant DNA technology. And just for some reason, just like, wow, that's cool. Because I saw all these possibilities, you know. Now, obviously, recombinant DNA technology, it gets to be like a little sci-fi, right? Because then you talk about, ooh, we're going to create monsters and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
But I got into the whole creativity of that side of science. Because I think previous to that point, I just thought science was kind of like people making measurements, and then, you know, I'm going to make these measurements, and then that's my science paper or whatever.
Right.
And I thought,
right.
No, but science could be creating. You could create stuff with science, and I could see how that could be done with recombinant DNA technology. So really, that's how I got into molecular biology, is via thinking about the types of things, the types of possibilities that you could do with recombinant DNA technology. And so that was in high school. And I kind of decided, if I'm going to do science, I'll probably end up being like what they affectionately call a gene jockey, which is somebody who does that type of work, you know, recombinant DNA, stuff. And it was funny because I, at one point, Bill had said, "Hey, you need to have a publishing company for your, you know, for your music publishing." And I wanted to call it Recombinant Music because I thought, well, because I'm a nerd, you know?
Yeah, like, sure.
That's so perfect. And then he goes, he looked into it and he said, "Dude, Devo already has that." So
wow.
So then I was like, oh, that. Well, then, yes, then it's kind of like a badge of honor that I chose the same one.
Yeah, that's a good way to lose. Yeah. This is like a lesson, too, to all teachers, you know, who feel like taking a day off or a week off or something, you know. If your teacher wasn't a pain who made you do that thing, who knows? Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, I think I had to thank, I think I might have seen her a few years after. I said, thanks for forcing me to do that oral report because it sent me down this, you know, career path, which is kind of fun.
Yeah, you would have just been a boring punk rocker without that, you know? What the fuck? So you were speaking of high school. You grew up in what, Lomita, California?
I grew up in Manhattan Beach, which is another just another suburb in that general area. The bigger area is called the South Bay of L.A.
Okay.
So like Lomita's South Bay, Manhattan Beach is South Bay. So I grew up in Manhattan Beach and Bill grew up in Redondo Beach and Frank grew up in Hermosa Beach. So just beach punks, bunch of beach punks.
And did you guys, you knew Bill in high school, correct?
Yeah. We were same grade, same school. And we were, I would say we were acquaintances, not really, friends necessarily until he sold me a copy of his first Descendant single.
Then
I was just like the biggest Punisher ever. I was like the first Descendants Punisher. And I would be like, "Hey, I got to go see you guys practice. Where do you guys practice?" "Oh, we practice at the church." "Okay, I'll see you at the church." You know, this kind of thing.
So, yeah. So you were just a Descendants fanboy kind of. That's how you got yourself into the picture.
I bought the record. And it was just like, this stuff's so cool. I'd started getting into at that point, LA punk rock. And I was listening to like the Germs and X and Black Flag and stuff. But then when I played, the first Descendants, single, that's Ride the Wild. To me, it was like, almost more Beatles-y girl, almost more, kind of poppy sounding and surfy sounding, Beach Boys sounding. And I thought, wow, that's like a different take on all of this. And, it really struck me as unusual and I really dug it. And so then I started going to their practices at the church and I met Black Flag and I met, the last and I met Red Cross they had a mic set up when the Descendants were practicing. They had a mic set up, but no one was stepping to the mic because they were just practicing instrumentally. Mm. And I said, "Well, that mic's got to be there for a reason." And I just said, "I said, well, how about if I just sing Ride the Wild just for shits, just for fun?" And they said, "Yeah, go for it, dude." And then I did it and I don't think I was very good, but they kind of thought, well, you know, I guess we need a singer maybe. So
that's awesome. And what was Bill pushing at the time? Was he like pushing a demo around school, a record? Like,
no, he put that single out himself on Orca Productions. That was his little label. But he wasn't, they hadn't really recorded anything besides these two songs, Ride the Wild and It's Hectic World. And I think they were just, they weren't stagnating, but they were definitely, they were definitely kind of maybe, I don't know, looking for a new style or just trying to kind of have fun in the practice room. I mean, you have to remember we were still in high school and it was just so much fun to be in the practice room, playing songs. And every once in a while, everyone's like, "Hey, I got a new song. Cool. Let's play it." And sure. By the time we recorded Milo Goes to College, we'd practiced solid for, a year and a half or something. Or more, like 2 years. And it was, there wasn't really a lot of demoing. There was no demoing. We just kind of worked all these songs out in the practice room and we'd play them live, but didn't really think about recording them, until we did Milo Goes to College. Well, we did do the Fat EP though, in the midst of all that, but yeah.
Right. Right. And what was the scene like for you guys? Where were the shows happening at the time? What were the bands you were playing with? What was like the local scene there at the time?
Well, there was starting to emerge kind of a South Bay scene, actually, because you had the Hollywood scene. That would be bands like X and the Germs played out in Hollywood, or were from Hollywood. But then there are all these bands coming out of South Bay. We're talking like San Pedro and Redondo and Hermosa. And those are the kind of bands that, because we were practicing at the church, that kind of took us under their wing and would help us, you know, get shows. They'd like Black Flag would put on shows and they would just have us open for them. And we did a lot of shows that way. Awesome. Minutemen as well. I mean, they were huge mentors for us. And so I'd say, you know, many of the shows we did were with the same set of like seven or eight bands that were all South Bay bands. Just cause you know, if you knew the other guys in the other bands, you could get on the bill, you know.
And where were the gigs happening? Were they in town in LA?
They were all throughout LA. I mean, there were a few clubs right there in South Bay. The Fleetwood was one, but most of the clubs were in Hollywood. So we play out in Hollywood. Right. I mean, my first show was out of the Hong Kong Cafe, which is in outside of Hollywood. Yeah.
So paint me a picture, because when you tell me what's going on, I imagine you and Bill are basically two parts of the Dogtown movie, because that's pretty much my frame of reference. Was it like that, or were you guys different than that? Like, what was the scene there? Was it about surfing, skating, and were you and Bill like, you know, were you guys the punk band in school that everybody liked, or were you like outcast punks as a result? Like,
well, we were. I can speak for, you know, Bill and I. We were not surfers by any stretch.
Okay.
Bill was more of a fisherman.
Right, right. He was a boat, right?
Yeah, he had a boat. He would go commercial fishing with Pat. With Pat and Frank. Pat was just a friend of his, but Frank, the guitar player, would also be fishing with him. And like he would come to school after having fished all night with fish guts all over himself. And so you can imagine we were not popular at the school. I was not popular, but that was just because I was, like I say, kind of a shy kid. I had my crew of friends, but I wasn't anywhere near like BMOC status or anything. And I just kind of laid low. I think we weren't really, you know, we may have been one of the only punk bands at the school at the time, but we weren't really, punk wasn't even cool then anyway. So we weren't really, winning any popularity contests.
Yeah. Like when, you know, Milo Goes to College came out, what, 82?
Yeah.
And, you know, at that point, you know, you sort of started the process of sort of jumping in and out of the Descendants based on school and stuff and, you know, your alternate interests. You know, do you have the impression that, I guess what I'm asking is, was the entire scene different than when, in 1982, was the choice to take the Descendants full-time basically like a choice to not have a real life or something like that? Is that like one of the reasons you needed to keep your foot in the other side, or do you think it was possible back then?
No, I had no inkling that it was possible.
Right.
I mean, the thing about the science thing is I genuinely did want to pursue a career in science, but also, as you said, I mean, it's like, I couldn't even envision, doing music as a career, not the kind of music that I was doing.
Right.
That didn't change till the 90s, really, where you could even go, oh, maybe this is something you could make a living at, you know? I think from those early days, I treated it as a hobby. I enjoyed it more as a hobby. And that's how it was continued to be until 2011 or thereabouts, right, when we got back together for this last longest incarnation, where I kind of thought, you know, this is something I could make a living at, you know. I actually didn't even start treating it as a career till I got laid off from DuPont. So we're talking like 4 years ago, I decided, oh, I could make a career out of this. Cool. Yeah.
So when you guys did Everything Sucks, right? That was like, so you were still thinking it was a hobby?
Yeah, because I was working as a postdoc. I was doing postdoctoral science. You'll have to ask your friend Nate about it. Is it Nate?
Yeah, Nate. Yeah.
Yeah. You'll have to ask him about postdocing.
Sure.
But it's basically you're kind of in this limbo between you've finished graduate school, but there aren't enough jobs available. So you have to go into this limbo thing before you can get a real faculty job. So that's what postdocing is. I was postdocing in Wisconsin, and I was kind of spinning my wheels and not getting anywhere. So I had written some songs and talked to Bill about it, and he said, "Yeah, let's put a record out." And then I decided, since the recording was so much fun, why don't we tour for a year? So that's how that kind of got shoveled. The band kind of got inserted into this period where I was in between, my career moves in science, basically. So yeah, even though we toured really hard in 96, we played hundreds of shows, but I was still kind of like, yeah, I'm going to finish this up and go back and finish my postdoc and, you know, going to go get a faculty position somewhere. It all seemed kind of still like I was on track even at that point.
It's really wild to hear, because from my perspective, when Everything Sucks came out, you know, everything I knew of the Descendants prior to then was from myth. And then, you know, Everything Sucks came out and there's this great record and this tangible band in front of my face. And I saw you on that tour at the Stone Pony in Asbury Park.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you asked me at the time, you were the Clash, you know what I mean? You were the Sex Pistols. You were like as big as that. And I don't think people understand that prior to, you know, maybe even the, you know, Green Day Offspring thing in the '90s, that avenue wasn't even really clear and there for people at the time. I mean, even some kind of shift, I think, happened around then. Did you see, like, the Descendants growing by default just when punk rock had its kind of minute in the mainstream there?
Yeah, I think we were helped by it. I think we were helped by it. People who checked out those other bands you mentioned are going to be, they were thinking, well, let's trace some of this back to there has to be something that existed before them. And we were one of the bands that they could trace back to.
You were one of the descendants of Green Day.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Sorry. I had to find that was for Jonah.
Yeah.
Big ups, Jonah.
Well, that's why they're called the Offspring, right? Because they're the Offspring.
Oh, yeah. This is perfect. This is perfect.
Yeah. So anyways, no. So I think we owe them, we owe those bands a debt of sort, because they really, you know, anyone who can make this style of music that we all play, you know, more available, make it more, something that everyone can get excited about, to create a buzz around it. That obviously helped us out to create that buzz, and they were the ones doing it. So I have to tip my hat to them for sure.
Awesome. I have a fun little game I want to play. I assume you're familiar with the periodic table of elements.
Yeah.
So I want to take four bands from the past and you tell me which element they represent.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Okay. So, Black Flag first.
Black Flag. They're iron.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. That's perfect.
Yeah.
All right.
Especially late Black Flag, later Black Flag.
Yeah, yeah, total iron. Okay, we got the Ramones.
Ramones. Helium.
Okay, we got the Minutemen.
Oh. I'm going to go with what's the one that's radioactive?
I think you're asking the wrong two. This is kind of your world, Milo.
They're uranium. Uranium.
Oh, good, good. All right, and last one, the Bad Brains.
Ooh, Bad Brains. Hydrogen.
Oh.
Perfect. I love it. That's all I got. Hydrogen. That's hydrogen, fun.
Well, just I think that they're primal. They basically are the primal band. For me, it's like when I first heard the Pay to Come single, that became the blueprint for what the Descendants were doing at that point.
Is that
because,
right?
Yeah. Because we were all about, like, let's drink as much coffee as we can.
Right.
And play as fast as we can. And then we hear the bad news, like, fuck, these guys beat us to it. They totally beat us to it. So that's why they're Hydrogen. Yeah.
I love that. Speaking of coffee, so to honor you, I drank a lot of coffee to get ready for this interview. I figured,
cool,
I might, you know, this how I'm going to pay homage to you. It's always been a big part of things for you guys. And last night I had to do a podcast at like 9 o'clock. And since I'm basically an addict to coffee, you know, since I know I have to do something at a time, my sole focus becomes to ensure that I have enough coffee to do that and do it well.
Yeah.
And I wonder, as someone who has been a coffee drinker as long, like how much of that is an invention of just my coffee addiction?
I mean, I think we're living in a, you know, in a time of coffee technology gone, you know, gone apeshit.
It's true.
I love it. I mean,
like the dystopian future of coffee right now. Well, you're right.
I mean, I've watched it evolve from like when we would go on tour in the 80s and we'd gotten sick of basically the bonus cup. I mean, the bonus cup, it only takes you so far until you're like ready to throw up.
Mm.
So we figured, we can't do any more bonus cups. So now what? Are we back? Are we relegated to 7-Eleven coffee?
Yeah.
I mean, and so then we're, you know, that level of desperation causes you to seek out the Italian restaurant in town,
whatever town
you're in, because that's the only place you can get an espresso in the mid 80s.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's Starbucks wasn't coming for another decade. Yeah.
No. So, and then of course, when Starbucks comes around, that was evolution number one. It's like, wait a minute. I mean, I don't have to find Luigi's restaurant to get myself a coffee. You know, I can just, like, I don't have to get an espresso. I can just go to Starbucks. So that was step one in the whole thing. And then to be able to bring that technology into your home and have home units that are as good as anything that Starbucks has, was, I think, another level. And so we used to have just a regular old espresso machines at home, and I'd gotten used to that. And then I realized you could buy these ones where you just push a button and it grinds the beans.
Yeah.
And it, you know, and so now we got one of those, and it's been kind of life changing for me. I first got it in the late 2000s, and I turned Bill onto it and said, hey, you got to check this out. And then I bought him a version of one of these, you know, all fully automatic things. And he said that I ruined his life for a while there, because his habit went from like 3 cups to like 30 cups in a day or something.
Yeah. I heard a story of him making like 10 espressos and just putting them in a thermos.
Yeah.
I have a hard time finding a cup of coffee now, you know, like if I'm driving through like Iowa and I'm trying to, you know, get that next step of the trip, and I'm like, all right, you know, I guess I'm going to the Sheets and getting some coffee. But back in the day in the 80s, I got to assume your options were really
terrible,
limited out there in the middle of the road. So what are we talking about here at gas stations at the time? Like single pot, one red, one black, you know, decaf, calf, and that's it?
It's decaf, calf, and the calf, you have no idea how long the calf has been sitting there.
Right.
It could have been sitting there for like 8 hours, and then you're just getting just sludge at that point.
It definitely was if you were there in the afternoon, man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The blacker the gold, the sweeter the juice. so what, like, I also heard that Bill sometimes pushes like 5-hour energies and stuff on you, even beyond the coffee.
We had a period of doing that, and I had to give it up. That was pretty early on in this recent incarnation of ours. You know, we started playing again in 2011, and we went down to Australia, and he was saying, hey, here's some 5-hour energy that you're going to take on top of regular coffee.
Right.
Cause you know, it's like, I got to have my regular coffee too. And I had some heart palpitation experiences I don't want to repeat. And actually even more frustrating for me than that was that you don't sleep after that.
No.
You know, you're up for like 40 hours at that point. And that's not a way that you can run a tour. You can't tour and not sleep. Not if you're the singer. That was just a disaster for me. It's like, I didn't realize at that point, like, that, you know, how much, you know, vocal preservation relies on basically two things, hydration and sleep. And that's
right.
it. If you do those two things, you're about 80% there. And I had some terrible experiences in Australia on that tour, just kind of dealing with the fact that I'd overindulged in this, in these caffeinated stimulants.
So you would just get hyped up for the show and then not be able to, not be able to come down. And was Bill just passed out? Like, it doesn't even hit him like that at all.
I don't know how he yeah. dealt with any of that, because he was equally wired.
Yeah.
But I can say that those were pretty bitchin' shows, except that I paid the price.
Yeah. Coffee mug was nice and fast.
Yeah.
So what's like the perfect routine then these days? In, you know, like perfect coffee routine throughout a day. Like, what's the great balance now?
Well, if I'm not planning on either singing at a show or singing for recording, all I do is I do two cups of coffee in the morning and I'm golden. I don't have to do any more coffee. There's no need to,
right.
You know, I don't necessarily experience any kind of lag in the afternoon. So that's to me is pretty cool, because then there's no issue with sleeping or anything. But yeah, if we're going to go play a show, I've got a coffee up before the show. You know, if Stefan, Carl, and Bill are coffeeing up and I don't, I'm just on a different page at that point. So we all coffee up. And
yeah.
You know, you mentioned with Bill, I don't go to his extreme of I'm going to have 10 espressos. But before a show, I'll probably have, you know, five coffees, you know, for sure.
Yeah, I was wondering, you know, like that part of, you know, since this is really the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, when you've been touring full time for the first time in your life, you know, since before that, you've taken so many breaks. Do you find a benefit from staying on the road and continuing to work on music that, you know, keeps your writing sharp, keeps your voice, you know, ready to go? And is it easier to just be in the Descendants without the lapses?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. I'm not so sure about the writing part of it, but definitely the vocal shape. Because I mean, it's always been a double-edged sword, and this was especially true in the '90s, that we would go on tour for 3 months, and you'd think, oh, that's a brutal tour or whatever. But my voice by the end of it was like killer, you know. It gets so leathery and so full, and I have a hard time replicating that level of conditioning or just, you know, vocal leather when we do shows now, because we go out for like, let's just say, a week, but then we're going to come home. So we all have to come home to be with our families and you know, keep from getting sick. So there's reasons to. The reasons why we have to do it that way, but it is definitely is not as ideal for vocal conditioning because, right. Yeah, like I said, I mean, and the way those tours would work back in the '90s, we go out for like 3 months, and the first week of the tour, my voice would just disappear. I'd be in the gutter. The
right.
voice would just be like this disastrous, like gravelly thing. But then you kind of pull out of that and you start to rebuild it a little bit. And then all of a sudden you've just got this really tough, tough vocal that you maintain for the rest of the tour.
Right.
And I look back and I go, yeah, I was miserable at times because I always felt like, you know, I'm not singing pretty.
Right, this ain't
pretty singing, but it was still sound, you know, people go, no, you sounded cool, you know, cause you you know, and that's funny cause even trying to replicate that in the studio. In the studio, sometimes Bill has me sing, you know, for a few hours, and I go, okay, we're done. He says, no, you're just getting started because now your voice sounds really fucked up.
Right.
So let's hit record now. You know,
he knows your voice pretty well, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So I mean, is this still like, you know, how much are you guys still encapsulating the, you know, the go for all mantra? Is that still feeling in the Descendants? Or, I mean, I heard you at some point, you know, be quoted as saying we got to go for all, but we want to go for all and not die.
Yeah.
So what's the balance at this age to still go for all? And
I think the idea is to go for all when you're on stage.
I see.
And to not go for all when you're not on stage. And that means that, you know, it may have been in the past we'd be like, get off stage and maybe we're going to, you know, do some partying or something, but I don't want to party anymore.
Right.
I just want, I want to kind of preserve my health and my vocals. You know, I'll have a beer after the show or whatever, but sure. I'm not going to go crazy. And, you know, it's all about getting sleep now. And I mentioned we don't want to do 3-month tours anymore, not only because of our families, but because, we want each show to just be all out. And it's a lot easier to have each show just be balls to the wall if you're not playing, you know, 100 shows in a row or whatever it's going to end up being, you know.
Sure. Do you find any of like the, you know, the advice from when you were a young man, like, do you find any of it incorrect? And would you like give a different set of advice, or would you like chip back the go for all thing now? Or do you think it's still a totally functional tool for people the way it's presented?
Well, I kind of feel like we always kind of had the notion of go for all being musically a thing to focus on the music,
right?
In terms of all, I mean, we probably didn't verbalize it so well at the start that you know go for all, but make that be all in music. And now I feel like that's still a known, or that's still a worthy thing is to go for all in your music. But yeah, maybe I would probably specify, you know, the music part of it and say, don't go for all in these other areas, you know.
It's, right.
You know, if you're into drugs, don't go for all.
Like, don't do all the heroin. Yeah.
Yeah. Or like even for coffee, don't go for all in coffee.
Plus 5-hour energy.
Yeah. So don't do that.
Well, I guess the band name Enough wouldn't have been as successful, you know.
Right, yeah. But I guess in other regards, though, I think about what I would tell my younger self.
Right.
And it doesn't have to do with all necessarily going for all, but it has more to do with like the notion of music as a career. I really kind of had it backwards a little bit in terms of like, well, you know, music's always going to be this like, it's always going to be this hobby thing, and or make sure you've got this backup career. You know, in my case, it was science or whatever.
Right.
And I kind of had that a little backwards at the start. Now we talked about how it, you know, conditions were different then.
Sure.
But I wished at some point I might have flipped the switch a little earlier and said, I'm going for it, you know.
I see.
I really only a few years ago decided to make this career. I probably could have decided much earlier and things would have been different, you know.
What made you so, you know, like sensible at a young age in such a kind of nonsensical world? Like, how did you have that perspective at that time?
I probably not really being, I don't know, not being a, not really being a punk per se. I mean, I played punk rock, but I was such a nerd at punk. Right. And I think that nerd angle probably made me think more, it probably allowed me to not glorify so much that lifestyle of like, ooh, punk rock or just rock and roll. I never really paid much attention or had much interest in, you know, glorifying it as a thing, like as a hero worship, as a lifestyle.
Right.
And that made it easier for me just to kind of go, eh, okay, I'm going to do this cause it's fun, but it's not the be all end all for me.
Yeah. And you didn't really like fully identify yourself as that.
No.
Yeah. Now, I was wondering, like, you know, when you're jumping from the academic world to the corporate world to punk rock clubs and back to the lab, did you find that you had to like wear many hats in all those environments, or do you feel like you were allowed to be exactly who you are in all of them?
It was difficult at times for me in science because you know, let's just say you're trying to prepare a talk. And you've got to, you got to be serious. You got to be, you got to put on your science hat. You got to think analytically, and your presentation is a lot different of a presentation than, for example, anything that I would do on stage. It wouldn't work over so well to stage dive at a scientific conference or anything like that. So,
I mean, but yeah, it makes you stand out.
definitely make some waves. But no, I think because there were times when people would I would tell people, you know, I sometimes struggled to give a research talk because I get so nervous.
Right.
You know, it's because it's a, like you said, it's a different hat.
Yeah,
yeah. You got to wear that different hat, and people will be like, "Well, you get in front of all these, yeah. you know, thousands of people." I go, "No, it's different because when I get in front of people to play punk rock, I literally, you know, you turn your brain off, or at least you turn off that analytical side.
Yeah,
and you're more in the moment. You're more feeling as opposed to thinking, and that right. just you know you can't do that for a scientific talk. So really, there was sure. already, yeah, it's. They are two like apples and oranges, and I really had to work on that for a while.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Well, you've got your gang on stage when you're right. I mean, you've got backup.
Yeah, true.
I mean, it's funny. I've been surprised that we've had people sit down for these podcasts who you know have played in front of 100,000 people and they're nervous.
I just went through the same thing, and people were making fun of me. My brother got remarried last year. And I, you know, I had to get up and do a speech.
Yeah.
And I was a goddamn mess. I'm yeah. sweating. My hand is shaking. You know, like my nieces are looking at me like, what the fuck is wrong with you? You serious? And they said the same thing. I'm like, listen, I'm not good at standing and pouring my heart out in front of a group of people. It's a lot easier to hit a bunch of fucking drums with your hair in front of your face, you know,
right,
like
exactly.
it's a totally
yep.
different experience. So you have two children, correct?
Yeah.
How old are they?
I have a 18-year-old son graduating high school and a 16-year-old daughter.
Cool. And I know your wife's a professor as well. Is it a very academic house? And did your kids wind up being very into education, academia, or music?
Yeah, I think that they've seen what we've both gone through. And it's going to help them, you know, hopefully navigate their if they do choose academic careers, it help them navigate those careers. My son wants to be he's a computer geek, and he wants to be work in computers. My daughter's, you know, she's only 16, but she's already thinking, oh, I want to be a physicist, you know. So
okay, there you
yeah.
go.
Oh, yeah, right. So they're both pretty serious minded kids. They see what we do and they kind of go, well, I guess this is an avenue we should consider.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah.
If they saw some success in it.
Yeah. So yeah, I think they're probably both headed for, you know, more academic or more academia.
And is that important to you? Like, is that something that, you know, you wanted for them? Do you think it's a good path to go down?
Yeah, I think it would definitely help. I'm not going to say that, you know, that they have to do it, but
right.
I think it would help them. Although I also know from my own experience that it's not the be all end all. I mean,
right.
I went as far as I could, got my PhD and had a go of it, but it definitely was not easy sailing for me in the academia. As I mentioned, I did that postdoc in Wisconsin and got really, really kind of down on the whole racket of, you know, academia and it's a buyer's market, I guess is the right way to put it or something. It's,
right.
It's,
right.
It's something where they churn out all these PhDs and don't offer them jobs at the end of it all. And you know, so you got these PhDs driving taxis or whatever.
Right. So and that's paying for, you know, 12 years of education and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So
yeah, sure.
I'll often make sure that my kids know that each of our situations, my wife and my situations are so, unusual. I feel very fortunate that I've been able to do both of the things that I've done. You know, both, neither one of those was it all by any stretch. A sure thing. You work with whatever fortunes you have to mm-hmm. make it happen. But they're very aware that, you know, that they can go off to school and get these advanced degrees and still be struggling. And that's just the fact of life now. Yeah.
Yeah, that's just
maybe you should tell them, you know, guys, I encourage you to get a doctorate if you're into it, but you know, you really have to love it. And if you don't,
yeah.
I think maybe you should go be a punk rock musician.
Yeah, if you take music full time, wait till your 50s.
Yeah, yeah. yeah.
So, Milo, listen, we have another segment here, sort of a game, that we call Mystery Friend.
Mystery Friend.
And what this is I'm going to ask you a question. scenario that hopefully you'll remember, that there wasn't a lot of people there, or there may have been a lot of people there, but it's not like probably not a story that everybody knows. And then you could give us the story and then see if you can guess who told us. So
who spilled the beans?
Do you remember the first time that you met Joey Ramone?
Pretty sure, because we were in New York playing at, I'm not going to remember the name of the club, but Coney Island High, it might have been.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I was sick as a dog. This is one of our 3-month tours where we all caught the scourge. Yeah. And I was at the hotel room trying to convalesce. And then I was going to show up at the show, at the last minute to jump on stage. And I get there to the show and there's Joey Ramone backstage. I was like, shit, man, I could have been hanging out with Joey Ramone this whole time.
Of all days.
And so I was like sick as a dog. It wasn't really like in the frame of mind to bro down with Joey. And I got there kind of late as well. So it's kind of a missed opportunity. But that was the one time I met him.
So do you have any, you probably don't remember who might've told us this. Do you have any idea who might've clued me into this story? Do you remember who introduced you to Joey?
No.
So, Max Huber from the Swingin' Utters.
Oh, okay.
Remember Max?
Yeah, totally.
So Max told me this story, and what you're telling me that you weren't feeling well kind of explains it, because he said that it was, he said it was one of this, I guess Joey had actually asked to be introduced to you as well.
Oh, wow.
And
oh, wow.
He described it as like these two punk rock legends, like kind of like at either end of the room. And it was like at a high school dance where they're both kind of too shy to introduce themselves to the other one. So they're like, can you introduce me to Milo?
Oh man, you're blowing my mind here. You're blowing.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because I mean, fuck, I had no idea. He's Joey's this, such a sweet person. I really wish I would have, you know, like I said, if I hadn't been sick and I'd gotten there earlier, we could have broed down it never happened. It's really kind of tragic. And yet to also hear, I'm just touched that he wanted to meet me too. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just really cool.
Yeah. That's pretty awesome. That's like a legendary thing you can always say.
Yeah. He was such a great human being. Yeah.
What was he like in person? Just mellow, good conversation, good listener?
Well, I mean, very quiet.
Right.
And I think the thing is again, missed opportunity. He was quiet. I was sick. And that I think it was pretty, I'm saying pretty short conversation, but you know, I think we got it across to each other that there was this, you know, mutual respect going on. In my case, more like mutual fandom, but you know, I honestly don't remember what got said, but just that we were, you know, just paying our respects. And great.
That's awesome. I feel like the realer the artists are, like the more awkward the conversation probably is anyway. It's like the first time I met Bill, I was like, oh my God, this is one of my drum heroes. Been biting his shit for half of my life, blah, blah, blah. I can't wait to meet Bill Stevenson. And we met and I'm like, oh, this guy's weird. Just like me. We're weird. And this is going to be a weird conversation. And I kind of love him more for it. Like if he was some politician, you know, who was like greasing me up and stuff, I'd be a little more suspect. I was like, yo, this guy's legit. Like, I don't think this is cool.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because my hero has always been John Doe pretty much.
Okay.
And I've now met him probably three or four separate times.
Okay.
And each time I meet him, I go, this is going to be the time where I like just pour my soul out to him, you know? Right. and I can't do it because I respect him too much to kind of put him in that position to be like, I'm, dude, you just sit there right now and I'm going to punish you. Just sit down and I'm gonna, you know, that's just like, no one wants that, you know?
Right.
And so, but the very last time I did do it, I kind of told him, like, be forewarned, I'm gonna punish you, because I had to tell him about the song I wrote on Hypercaffeine, which is called Full Circle.
Right.
And I said, okay, I'm going to quote you some lyrics and you're just going to have to take it, you know? and I quoted him the first part of the song. He's like, yep. Okay. Thanks. You know, I mean, what else could he say? Right, some guy comes up to him, like, you're like, you basically inspired my entire life, yeah. You know?
So, dude,
you know.
Listen to my poem. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
So, you know, I've always felt very connected to your lyrics in a lot of way where, you know, for, you know, a lot of music and lyrics specifically don't always connect with me. Like I'm going to listen to the drums. I'm going to listen to the melody first. And unless the lyrics are really standing out to me or they're really terrible, I usually don't notice them that much. And Descendants is one of the bands where like song after song, you're one of the writers where like song after song, I'm just like feeling something I connect with in a very real way. And I heard a story. So I want to tell you a story that connects us together. Okay. Mm. So when I was first dating my now wife, she was my girlfriend not that long. I was full time touring and I had, had her out to London to spend a few days with me when I was doing some shows there. And we're having a day out on the town. I don't remember what I had, probably too much coffee and some sort of fried food in England. And we run all the way down to a subway station. It was one of the ones that's about, you know, 300 steps down, takes forever. We're waiting for a train and my stomach hit. And I was like, you know, it's one of those situations. I'm like, I'm either shitting my pants or I'm walking up these 300 steps and finding somewhere to go with. But here's this beautiful young woman who just flew out to London to hang out with me and be my girlfriend. This is a bad situation. But I had to come clean and I just was like, yo, this is what's happening. I'm sorry, but I have to go find somewhere to shit or else it's going to be bad, you know? And we walked up and I did it and I got out and there was like very little fanfare about it. And it kind of gave me this indication. I'm like, you know what? This might work. Cause yeah. You know, this is going to happen again. And this is, you know, what happens in life. And I kind of like the fact that there was really no reticence about what happened. I heard a story you said that early in the courtship with your wife, a bridge that you crossed was when you ripped a huge fart in front of her and she didn't tear your head off. And you thought the same thing. Okay, I can live with this person and she's the girl for me.
Yeah, yeah. It definitely was like a... it was definitely like a moment of realization that, right, this could work. This is going to work. And I think, it continues to this day that she tolerates my gas, which has only gotten worse. It's only gotten worse as I got older.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm same.
But I mean, her name for me right now is Old Dog. I'm known as Old Dog because it's that bad. And I can say that maybe her tolerance is somewhat less now. Right. I think, I get a little more flame. I get a little more flame from her.
I think she needs to recognize. I mean, part of being Old Dog is the fact that you wouldn't have control over it anymore. Right.
Right. You know, I think she's I think she's convinced I can have control but I just refuse to have control, which is,
right.
You know, I guilty as charged. I'm pretty bad about all that. I actually wrote a song about it. It was like, it's a song about, the intersection of farting and romance together.
Does it have a title yet?
It's called Light a Candle.
Yeah. Maybe you need parentheses scented.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cause I mean, I don't know about you guys, but you know, it's when you get intimate with someone, sometimes someone lights a candle to get intimate.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to go in the bedroom and you're going to get intimate.
I'm a Teddy Pendergrass fan, man. Turn off the lights and light a candle.
Light a candle. Yeah. But sometimes I also hear, God damn it, light a candle, man. Yeah.
So, that's awesome. So,
it's a country song, by the way.
Old dog. So is there any sort of talk within the group and the band on a, like a timeline and what you guys are planning on doing for next record and how long you're just planning on keeping the full-time descendants thing going.
Yeah, well, that timeline, of course, is affected by COVID, but at the same time, we can record during this whole period. We obviously have no shows, but we can record them. We have recorded about, we tracked about, I'm going to say 30 songs.
Oh, cool.
But mostly, or almost entirely, those are Stefan's and mine's songs.
Okay.
Stefan's just been incredibly prolific in terms of writing.
Just cranking them out.
Yeah, he wakes up in the morning and says, I'm going to write a song today. Or, you know, like, I don't know if he averages a song a day, but it's just something crazy like that.
Wow.
So he has just so many songs that he never writes words for. So I've been writing words for his songs. And then I've got my own songs that I've worked up by myself. So what we're doing is waiting for Bill to write some songs and Carl to write songs, because we really can't put a record out unless, you know, all four members are
Sure, are
contributing. So we're in a bit of a, it's, you know, we did the recordings and we're in a bit of a limbo because we're just kind of waiting for Bill and Carl to put some stuff together. And it's one of those things. Bill's not very prolific, but when he does write a song, it's going to be the best song on the record. So we kind of have to just wait.
You're waiting for Bill's golden nugget.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's awesome. So I don't know how else to phrase this question, because I don't know. I don't want to soften it up. Did you invent pop punk?
No, I feel like pop punk existed before us, because I think of bands like the Buzzcocks, you know, and the Dickies, and bands like that I felt like, you know, maybe a band like the Buzzcocks is not really easily placed in categories, but then you just have to argue categories are useless anyways.
Yes.
Because right. I would, you know, I'd either put them as power pop or I'd put them as pop punk, but you can't, there's something in that kind of realm of things. And they were a huge influence on us. Hmm. I loved the Buzzcocks back then. So I feel like what we did maybe was gave it a more hardcore, flavor, but, you know, I've often kind of tried to push back on, you know, that moniker of inventing pop punk. It just seems a little too cut and dried, a little too black and white, when there's so many gray areas of other bands that came before us.
Of course.
But having said that, I love the genre. I mean, I still listen to pop punk. You know, it's a great merging of my love of the Beatles with my love of the Germs, you know,
and
that's kind of, I'd probably go to my grave just still digging it.
I mean, I think the thing you guys did, you know, opposed to those bands like Buzzcocks and Dickies, was, you know, less about the music. Because you're right, the music's there, the choruses are strong, the melody's strong. Like, there's a true pop element to those songs. But you guys gave it that California sensibility. You know, you guys gave it the feel that became, you know, a couple eras of pop punk. You know, where you're allowed to be silly. You're allowed to write a song about being hungry or being at a drive-thru or something like that. And I don't know. I didn't hear anyone doing that first. So maybe the pop element is less musical and more kind of, you know, sociocultural sort of in that way.
Right. Yeah.
I want to ask a question here, if I could. Obviously, we're always trying to get funny and embarrassing stories about music, but since you also have that second career, I'm just wondering if you have any like wacky science stories.
Oh yeah.
Well, probably the wackiest science story I come up with deals with the intersection between my two worlds, because I applied it for my job at DuPont, and part of applying for that job was that I had to give a job talk, which is where you roll in and all these very serious scientists sit in chairs and you talk about your research. And I gave that job talk. And after the talk, I'm talking to some of the scientists and they're saying, oh, good talk, blah, blah, blah. And these three guys show up and say, can I get your autograph? You know, and I was like, and I'm sitting there going, I didn't plan this. Trust me, I did not plan to have these three guys show up and ask for my autograph after my job talk. You know? it's kind of, so that was kind of like, you know, that was step one of me you know, acing that job interview right. was these three guys. Then I had the head of the company, or actually the head of the division, I guess it would be, who then said, "Oh, who were those guys?" I said, "Oh, they're." I had to explain my you know, alter ego or whatever, and he said, "Well." And he said, "Oh, I'd love to see you play sometime." And I said, "Well, I said All's playing in Philadelphia, and they wanted to come see me get. They said you could get on stage." So next thing I know, I go to the All show in Philadelphia, and the head of the division is showing up with his wife, and they're waiting in line to come see me play. And I go, "Oh my God, this is like part two of the job interview."
Right.
Is this guy's going to show up? And I thought, I can't fuck this up. I got to be really on my A game in terms of what I was doing, you know?
Well, I guess you nailed it.
Well, then I think we did, you know, we did Coolidge or something on stage or something. And after that, I said, "Okay, I hope I get the job." And so it all worked out in the end.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah. That's really funny. Yeah. Any explosions?
No,
that's that different kind of science.
Oh yeah, hypercaffeine. We had explosives for hypercaffeine, but that was, of course, all part of the gag. Right. The gag of hypercaffeine.
Yeah, but yeah,
no. Yeah. I mean, the kind of stuff I was working on was pretty safe.
Right.
Yeah, you know,
small.
It's all DNA.
You need microscopes to do what you're doing.
Yeah, and small amounts of chemicals, some of which are toxic, but small amounts of them. Yeah.
Right. So I personally know two children named after you. Have you met a lot? Is this a worldwide phenomenon? It seems like there's quite a few.
Yeah, I've met maybe I could probably count them on two hands, but maybe not even on one hand. So it's kind of unusual. I guess it's gratifying. Although I always tell them that I used to get a lot of shit for my name growing up. So,
right.
I guess it's nice that that, you know, it's no longer a name that gets you teased. Maybe now it's improved, but.
Well, but I think what you could feel good about is that. So when I was naming my son, you know, I considered calling him Bonham. I thought it'd be cool.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I think about it a little bit and I'm like, 27-year-old guy asphyxiates on his own vomit. Like, maybe not the best precedent, you know?
Right,
as much as I love John Bonham's drumming, you know, they're eventually going to look this up, you know? And
named me after this druggy guy.
Right, exactly. So I think you should feel good about the fact that parents not only think your name is cool, they must have faith in the fact that you're not a garbage human being. And, you know, they don't mind naming their kids after you, and they'll look into it and actually be proud. Maybe this is a sort of half-hearted attempt for parents to get their kids into school.
That'd be nice. No, I've always been gratified that if people, you know, see what I'm doing in these two areas, and it's going to make it so that maybe that the people just don't always think of punks as being, you know, druggies. You don't have to be a druggie to be a punk.
Right.
You can be a student and be a punk. And it maybe takes some of the, you know, dinginess out of that particular designation.
For sure.
It's a punk. So yeah.
That's cool. All right. So this is my last question. We can let you go. So, you know, I'm a big fan of, When I Get Old. Great song. Yeah. And, you know, at the time, I'm listening to it with you, and I'm like, huh, I wonder, you know, what's going. So now we have over 20 years of time since you wrote that song till now. Do you still ride your bike around town?
Oh, I wish.
Okay.
that gets back to living in Delaware. Which
yeah,
is kind
right.
Of,
you're out of bike country now.
It's kind of a pit for that. I try to ride it. I live fairly near a state park, so I can, you know, I can. Will I still ride my bike in the state park after schlepping it on my vehicle? Yes, I will still do that.
Yeah. Okay, so part of it. Do you still sleep on the floor?
Not at my own house, but at someone else's house, maybe.
I sure. Don't,
yeah.
Do you still hate the cops?
Yeah, I still do. Oh man, what? You know, I don't think a day has gone by where you don't see some video of a cop putting his knee into someone's neck.
Yeah, yeah, it's crazy.
And just like, well, in this last one I saw, they killed him.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I think the thing is there's got to be some way that I think the techniques are already there, but the cops have to learn the techniques.
Yeah.
And they got to follow the techniques, and they can't lose their shit.
Right.
And there's just too much of the, like, you know, just not following protocol, or just, yeah, I think if they were to just do a better job of following these techniques, then they maybe wouldn't be considered such assholes, because they you see these videos and you're just like, okay, you're not doing yourself any favors here, you guys.
Yeah, right.
You guys are assholes.
Yeah, yeah, there's no question about it. I mean, it's almost like just giving too much power to people who are wildly untrained. You know, it's like, I've seen it. To become a local cop, you know, you got to get out of high school. You basically got to go take a course for a while. You know what I mean? Yeah. And then you're a cop. And then you carry a gun and you're essentially allowed to make something up and shoot me. So it's just like, I don't know. I try to, you know, pick it back to the fact that these people aren't inherently bad. Every single one of them. I think a lot have good intentions.
Right.
But you can even see, like, in some of those videos, that Philando Castile one in particular, where I'm like, that cop was scared. That cop was just a kid. He was a kid who didn't know what the fuck he was doing, who got scared and made a bad decision and took a life because of it. You know?
I mean, it's not his fault he was scared, but it's his fault that he just couldn't utilize whatever training, or, you know, either he didn't get trained or he didn't utilize his training. The training that tells you what you do when you're scared, because they're gonna get scared. There's no doubt about that.
Of course,
but they got to use their training. Yeah.
All right. So last one, we took a little course. Do you still talk about the old days?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'd probably do that more now than ever, just because they're so important to me, to who I am today.
Sure.
I mean, like, for example, when we were talking about how I got into the band and just that whole phase of when I got into LA punk rock and everything, it still means so much to me to think about how special that time was in terms of, you know, it may never happen that way again. Who knows? I mean, I'd like to think that some other generation will come along and have that kind of blossoming of this particular music at that time, but I'm just fortunate that it happened to me.
Sure. Yeah. That's awesome.
So yeah, I'm more than happy to wax nostalgic about it. I feel like perhaps there's an embarrassment to something like that. Cause then you're the old codger. You know, at the same time, it was a time that meant so much to me. And it was a time that allowed my creative side to kind of leave its shell.
Awesome.
That was so important. Yeah.
Well, I thank you for it, man. And the work you've done has been inspiring to me for a really long time. And I don't even know if I'm doing what I do the way I do it without all of you. So I appreciate it, man.
Cool. Paying it forward.
Try.
That's because, I mean, we could say this, I think I talked about John Doe or whatever. We have all these people that we also just, you know, revere. And I look back at them and I just think this is why I probably finally decided I can do this as a musician, because the passion never dies.
Right.
The passion is always there because you see it as a continuum of music that kind of rides this wave of enthusiasm and then gets picked up by the next generation because they're enthusiastic about it and just keeps riding the wave.
That's right.
And it's like, you know, that's why I keep doing it. I feel like it's something that'll never die.
Respect your elders, kids. All right, Milo, thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate you taking all this time.
All right.
Yeah, thanks, Milo.
See you later. Bye.
Milo.
Hey, so thank you, Max Huber, Swingin' Utters, for the mystery friend story. I got to be sure. Thank Max, because that was a good one. That's a good story.
Yeah, that was good, especially getting a Ramones cut. That's nice.
I was trying to figure out when he first told me that story, like why I wasn't. I would have been there. That time period, I was hanging out at that club a lot, and I realized I was on the road. I looked it up.
Where were you? Where were you that day?
I think that was maybe the Sam I Am tour.
Cool.
We were out with Sam I Am for like over 3 months.
Oh wow!
Yeah, I think that was like 95 or 96. I have to look it up.
And that was kind of like that was almost at like the height of their powers too, right?
Sam I Am
was pretty big in those
clumsy
days.
It was a Clumsy record. It was so much fun. That was a fun tour, dude.
That was my Sam I Am breakthrough album, was Clumsy, for sure. I've covered Capsized like everyone else and their mother has.
So yeah. Good, dude. So
have
good.
To. But that was so awesome that Milo did that. I tried not to fanboy too much in that interview, but Descendants are a really important band to me, like to the point that I might not be like a punk rocker without him. You know, I remember the first time I ever heard him, and it was sort of strange. Like my entrance into like punk and hardcore was through my first band. Like I was like kind of still like a grunge rock kid up until I joined that band. And then I joined and the singer John and the guitar player Torsten were pretty like heavy into the hardcore scene already at that time. They were a couple years older than me. So they booked a show at our guitar player Joe's house in his basement and managed to get this band Strength 691 to come, who was like one of the bigger, more well-known hardcore bands in Jersey, I could do another podcast on Strength 691 and their importance to my life. But, and I remember they played that show and they covered Camage, and I was like, oh man, who's this? And I was soaking up anything I could at the time. And I went to one of those record shows with my mom. And the only Descendants disc I could find was Hall Raker Live. So that was my intro to Descendants. Like nice. I had no other Descendants record for a couple years. And basically all my favorite Descendants songs are the ones that they played on Hall Raker. And then in like 90, you know, 5 or 6, you know, I kind of missed the whole All era.
Right.
I was a little too young. And then in 95, 96, I was actually like a proper punk rock kid and Everything Sucks came out.
Right.
And that was like my Descendants record, you know, like this one's for me
because
I'm here now, you know, and I immediately fell in love with it. I went down to their show at the Stone Pony in Asbury to see them.
Nice.
And that's where I reconnected with a guy named Paul that I sort of knew from that band, Strength 691, in that scene. And he asked if I still played drums, and he had a band called Yell Boy at the time. And, you know, because of that show and meeting him again, I started playing in that band, which subsequently turned into like the Low End Theory, who was like my first real band that got signed and toured and like did the whole thing. And connected me with these kids from like the Woodbridge, Perth Amboy area of New Jersey, which is, you know, were my best friends for years. And so, I mean, literally, like before I was even 16, the Descendants shaped my path in so many different ways, you know?
Yeah, that's sweet, dude.
So this was another one, just like that Liz Goldwyn one, like, I was nervous. That's why I was like asking the scientific questions at first. I was like, listen, I want him to know that I did a little homework here and I respect his craft as a scientist. So, oh yeah, big shout out too to my buddy, Nate Morris, who provided me with the insight on molecular biology.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, he luckily called me on his way to work at like 7:30 in the morning before that interview and gave me a brief rundown of what the fuck he was talking about.
Molecular biology for dummies.
I actually, even when I was texting Nate, he's like, who's this for? I'm like, imagine it's for a 9-year-old. And then give me that. Like, that's basically what I told him. Yeah. Yeah, man, that was awesome. So glad Milo did it. And
hey, the Patreon is up.
Yeah, give us money.
I feel guilty because people have been giving us money, Venmo at Off Track, been a lot
and
of
that
very,
gives them nothing.
So at least now we can maybe give you a little bit back. So the Patreon account is up. Go to patreon.com. Going off track, if you want to be our patron, and we'll have a little bit of bonus content, including I just realized I've got some bonus content from this podcast that I'm going to put up for patrons on the Patreon account.
I was just sweaty and hot and crazy during that intro. I hope it's not that.
No, it's the outro where not only do we continue to talk a little bit about Joey Ramone, but Green Day and Jesse Malin.
Oh, right. That was cool stuff. So, yeah, but anyway, thanks to anybody who does that. Truly appreciate it. And it will give us the ability to do this silly show well and for a long time, I hope.
Yeah, and, you know, what's free is giving us a good review on iTunes. And also, like, you know, subscribe. If you subscribe to the podcast, it just gives us good – it makes us look good. It'll just help ensure that we're around longer.
To whom? To whom, Brad? Who are we pandering to here? The big men?
You know,
are we
like
trying to get on Spotify?
Follow us on Instagram and Twitter.
Also, the Descendants are on Instagram and Twitter, and they actually were able to claim the Descendants since they used an E instead of an A.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So it's at Descendants for both of those.
So check them out. Go listen to all their music if you have not.
Yeah, what would you recommend an 18-year-old to start on? Well, the new records are pretty good, man.
I don't think I've really listened. I mean, I've heard some of the newer stuff, but I haven't really listened to anything since Everything Sucks, which is a phenomenal record, which I think is I mean, obviously I was exposed to them earlier, but Everything Sucks is I would say that record. It's so good. I mean,
my buddy Colin, who's a listener of this show and significantly younger than both of us, I asked him to give me like his top 7 Descendants records or whatever it was. And he had a couple of the older ones way towards the end and a couple of the, I mean, we even say newer, they're not that new. Like some of their post Everything Sucks records are, you know, close to 10 years old.
Right.
And he is a huge fan of those records. And I honestly, besides for the last one, the Hypercaffeum Spazinate, I honestly didn't look at those records too much until Colin mentioned it. And I'm getting into it. I haven't dug as hard in as I'm going to yet. But honestly, they got teeth and songs. And I'm like, oh, wow, like these are really good.
Yeah.
And the Descendants are just continuing to write like kind of perfect pop punk songs, man. They just never stop.
Yeah.
It's great.
No.
We need them. The world needs the Descendants so bad. That's always what we've needed.
Yeah, I agree.
Clean sheets are dirty for a guy who sleeps on the floor, you know? I've heard that line so many times and just been like, yeah, man. Yeah.
Oh, shit. I almost forgot to mention the new Mystery Friend theme. Did you notice?
Yeah.
That's from Mark Stromberg, a Swedish Going Off Track fan. Dropped it in there. The original theme, which we've been using for a couple of years from Evan Moore and Linda Everswick, is awesome, and it will not be forgotten. We will continue to use both, but Mark's is pretty cool. Thanks again. Benny, stay safe. Watch out for those tornadoes.
I will. Take it easy, Brad.
Thank you out there. Keep your heads down and, you know, support the cause, okay? Whatever that may be.
We love you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.